Parrish.
Great, thank you. So I'm going to focus a little more on the convective stability on the other side of things. And again, I'll show some simulations that have been done by our student, Mike McCourt, and of course, Elliot and Pratik are closely involved in this work. So as Mateusz gave a wonderful explanation yesterday introducing all of these local linear instabilities, so I'm not going to go through these in that much detail. I'll presume everyone paid close attention yesterday. But the point is we've now identified over the last several years, two different instabilities, the HBI, the heat flux driven buoyancy instability, which operates in the inner parts of clusters where the temperature gradient is positive, and that's dying, and the MTI, which operates in the outskirts of clusters where the temperature is declining with increasing radius. And what these do is these are both buoyancy instabilities, which suggests that the entire cluster can be convectively unstable. So I'm going to tell you about some of the new developments we've had in the last year or so. And that I think we really completely understand the saturation of these instabilities now. And we're starting to grapple with what effects they really mean in terms of real observational consequences for galaxy clusters. So first of all, I just want to remind you, show you this. I have to show at least one movie since I'm a simulator, of the physics of the heat flux driven buoyancy instability. And this just starts with initially vertical field lines and the temperature gradient. It's hot on top and it's cold on bottom, which the colors reflect. And as this begins to evolve, the heat flux driven buoyancy instability saturates in such a way, this is a multi-mode situation, where the magnetic field lines end up being primarily horizontal, and the velocities in the saturated state are also horizontal. So this is a nice, gentle, quiescent saturation. And basically what we can do is we can compare what happens when we take the HBI and we look at the effects of turbulence on it. So in the past slide, there was no turbulence, it just quiescently saturated. And we have a hope of trying to understand sort of a recipe for what the saturated state might be. And so I'm going to show you here, we're going to pick another dimensionless number. And in this case, it's going to be the ratio of the HBI growth time, which is roughly the buoyancy time in the system, to the eddy turnover time, which is the time for turbulence to stir the system on a given scale. And you can think of this in terms of the Richardson number, or if you prefer nautical terms, the Froude number. And there's two limits. And what I'm plotting here is this is the saturated magnetic field angle. This is the Spitzer fraction, the effective thermal conductivity, versus this dimensionless number. Well, in one limit where there's not much turbulence, it's just like you saw in the movie on the last slide. The HBI is very efficient. The HBI growth time is much faster than the eddy turnover time. And the Spitzer fraction basically approaches zero. In the other case, where turbulence, where the eddy turnover times is rapid, the HBI starts to set up, but then comes the turbulent eddy and it washes all of it out, and you end up saturating almost exactly to isotropic conductivity or a Spitzer fraction of a third. And what we've done in this paper, which I encourage you to look at, is basically this is a recipe. If you tell me what the condition is for the HBI growth time, which just comes from gravity and the temperature gradient, and you estimate what the eddy turnover time is from the turbulence, I can tell you what the effective Spitzer fraction will be. All right, so let's actually simulate this in a model cluster. So we start with something that looks vaguely like Abel-2199 and hydrostatic and thermal equilibrium. We put entangled magnetic fields, and then and the HBI should grow in something like 100 megayears. On top of this, we're also going to drive turbulence. So this is similar to what Mateusz talked about yesterday, where we drive turbulence with a given velocity and at a given outer scale. And so what do you see? Well, you see this shocking bimodality that results. So what I'm showing here is this is the exact same initial conditions. And we're putting turbulence in with an outer scale of 40 kiloparsecs. And these lines represent turbulence going from 34 kilometers per second on the outer scale to 142 kilometers per second. And one point I want to make is this turbulence is not energetically dominant. It's less than 0.1% of the cooling luminosity. So it's not the action of the turbulence dissipating that's actually heating our system up. And what's happening is, well, if you look at this, the HBI growth time is about 100 megayears, the cooling time is about 400 megayears, and as we vary this ratio of the eddy turnover time to the HBI growth time, we either latch onto a cooling flow solution or we latch on to a system that's almost exactly an isothermal profile, kind of like a non-cool core cluster. And so Pang and Mateusz also have some very nice results on this, which I encourage you to look at in their paper, and also where they use some galaxies to stir the turbulence. And just to make the point that it's not just the velocity of the turbulence, so let's do a different experiment. So now we're going to inject the same amount of velocity, 115 kilometers per second in the outer scale, but we're either going to drive it at 40 kiloparsecs or 100 kiloparsecs. Depending on what you think might be the source of turbulence, you might have different outer scales. And so this gives different eddy turnover times, where in this case, you basically, turbulence keeps the conduction roughly at almost exactly the Spitzer value. So this is 60 degrees for an average magnetic field angle. So this is 1/3 of Spitzer. Or in the other case, the HBI is faster than the eddy turnover times. It shuts off conduction, so this is less than Spitzer, and you run away to a cooling catastrophe. To place this in a more observational context, in the nice results from Mark and Megan, where you're looking at this entropy in the bimodality, these low entropy clusters, all the signs point towards AGN feedback. So, and we're having local thermal instability, as Elliot talked about in the last talk. So there's H alpha emission, there's radio indicative of feedback, whereas these high entropy populations are the ones with the longer cooling time, there's no feedback indicators, and these are preferentially your non-cool core clusters. And so, for example, one thing that's interesting is if we just take one of our simulations where we start with a cluster with a fairly low central entropy, 11 keV centimeter squared per second, and we drive turbulence with 250 kilometers per second, we're actually able to elevate the entropy up to 110 keV per centimeter squared. So we're able to transition between these two populations. Whereas in the other case, if for some reason your turbulence were to turn off, the HBI would turn on, it would turn conduction off, and you could eventually fall back to the lower population. And so what I want to argue is it's not the turbulence that's changing your entropy. The turbulence is effectively a catalyst. It's not energetically strong enough, but what it's doing is it's randomizing the field lines, and it's allowing conduction to take effect. And so the conduction is then a volumetric way to raise the entropy. But what I want to make very clear is conduction cannot stably balance cooling in a cool core cluster. There's no way to stay in this cool core state and have conduction stably balance the system. You're going to have to resort to what we see is, in fact, suggested by the observation, some sort of AGN feedback to reach a stable equilibrium. So let's just put all my chips on the table here and make a prediction for Astro H. So if you sort of turn this argument around the other way, I think for a typical cluster like Abel 2199, where the inner temperature goes from 2 keV to something like 5 keV, you're not going to see a cool core cluster with strong levels of turbulence. So anything in this case greater than 150 kilometers per second, you know, given this particular outer scale. So maybe if you drive turbulence on very small scales, this could be violated. But so this is my prediction for Astro H. And in fact, it's consistent with a lot of the results we've heard yesterday, where cool core clusters don't seem to have a lot of turbulence. Andy showed that the filaments are very straight. Norbert showed this as well. There's these Jeremy's direct RGS measurements from Chandra, the resonance scattering, and what Eugene just talked about with the smooth surface brightness profiles. All right, let me change gears here, and we're going to try and very quickly demonstrate some new results on the MTI. So this is the instability that operates in the outer part of the cluster, and for a long time we thought it was the dual of the HBI. We thought it was just like it, where the HBI takes vertical field lines and makes them horizontal. We thought the MTI could take horizontal field lines and make them vertical. It turns out this is actually not the case, and it doesn't saturate quiescently at all. So if we turn our head here and actually think we start with what we thought was the stable state of the MTI, vertical magnetic fields, we find that this isn't actually the case. Because now, if you make a small horizontal displacement, these horizontal displacements are not damped. There's no restoring force in the horizontal direction. So it's now non-linearly unstable. You can reseed the MTI and close the dynamo loop. And now, in the saturated state of this system, you can't tell if you started with horizontal magnetic field lines or vertical magnetic field lines. So let me just tell you a few facts about how this saturates. It does not saturate with vertical radial fields in the cluster sense. There is a small bias over isotropic fields. It generates vigorous turbulence. In local simulations, we've seen supersonic velocities. It generates a magnetic dynamo in our local simulations that can raise you almost up to equipartition with the magnetic energy and the kinetic energy. And the turbulence does not suppress the MTI. You cannot reach the statistical steady state that you reached with the HBI in some sort of uniform angle with the field lines. And in fact, I'll show you in a few slides, turbulence and the MTI turbulence are actually additive. So what do we do? So you saw some Mateus showed some cosmological simulations yesterday. And in this case, what we're trying to do is now we're just trying to back off, you know, because cosmological simulations are very hard to analyze. So we've taken a local simulation, But, you know, because you see clusters with these observed outer temperature gradients, what do? Well, we set something up that looks like this case is a rather big cluster, and we pin the temperature here at the inner part, and we pin the temperature at the outer part. And we don't run any cooling in these simulations, and we watch to see how this evolves. And in this case, for this fairly massive cluster, the growth time of the MTI is about 600 megayears. So what do you see? Well, so what I'm plotting here is I'm plotting the RMS Mach number versus the radius. And in this case, R500 is actually all the way out at almost a megaparsec, because this is quite a large cluster I simulated here. And it turns out that the MTI can actually provide significant pressure support in the outskirts of the cluster. In fact, the maximum Mach numbers in these simulations are supersonic. So if you look at this blue dotted curve, this is just the MTI alone, and we find that, you know, it generates moderate levels of turbulence. But here you see if we add a driven turbulence on top of it, we eventually get the black curve. So they don't add exactly linearly, but they're not. The turbulence isn't depressing the MTI. So whatever turbulence you think might already be there from structure formation and mergers is just adding to whatever turbulence is driven by the MTI. And just to get a handle on how this scales, I'm going to show you basically our fiducial simulation, but I'm going to show you with a few different temperature drops. So this is dropping 3.5 kV from the maximum to R500. This is dropping 4.5 kV and 5.5 kV. And you can see that this turbulent velocity is actually scaling directly with the temperature difference. And so in this case, this is really something you have to think about when you're looking for biases in the SE signal if you're getting non-thermal pressure support, because this is something that's going to scale with temperature and correspondingly with mass. And at the same time, I've actually been told by some of my colleagues during this program that, you know, we need to extend this actually even beyond R500, since so much of the SE power spectrum is actually coming from beyond there. So we're going to work on extending that in future results. And so let me just show my conclusions. So for cluster cores, the HBI alone would saturate with azimuthal magnetic fields, but if you add turbulence, we can give you a recipe for telling you exactly what the Spitzer conductivity is. And it looks like it's almost certainly an easy way to establish this bimodality between cool cores and non-cool cores. And I'm going to make this prediction that cool cores are going to have weak turbulence. And in 2013, I'll either be right or wrong. And in the cluster outskirts, this is something that we're learning, is that this instability doesn't saturate at all like the HBI. It doesn't saturate quiescently with these beautiful radial magnetic field lines. And it can actually provide a significant source of non-thermal pressure. And in fact, it scales with both the mass and the temperature gradient. So thank you.
Ian, can you say something about the turbulent power spectrum that the MTI turbulence produces? Is that any different from what you get from other sources of turbulence?
Yeah, so I don't have a slide on that, but it tends to be peaked at large scales, actually. So that tends to be where most of the power is, and then it cascades down.
I just wanted to comment that when you showed the bimodal distribution of entropies and you said that there was no feedback in the, I think was it the other one.
Yeah, I'll get there.
You got to wait for that. I think in fact I don't think it's clear that there are no feedback indicators in the long cooling time system. Certainly, you know, as Andy mentioned in the cool cores. And as Megan mentioned as well, you know, the duty cycle is probably, they're just on, the radio sources are on, but there's still significant power input into the, there's evidence for significant power input, even into the ones that you wouldn't call a cool core. So I think the upshot there is it's not clear what's happening there.
Yeah,
it's not clear whether it's...
I'll agree. I think it was definitely a little glib in saying that there's no feedback indicators. And in fact, I think we may find that there's a little bit more of a green valley, so to speak, between these two populations, to mix metaphors.
I would just say there may still be significant heating. Hmm. It's not clear whether it's a feedback effect, but there's significant heating.
Okay, thank you, Ian.
Last, we have Alex Shekuchihan from